This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the Green Mountain Care Board gave its approval to an overall statewide increase of 3.1% in the budgets of Vermont's 14 hospitals. That's less than half of what the budget increase was between 2008 and 2012. Green Mountain Care Board Chairman Al Gobe says that decrease in growth is necessary to get us on the road to single payer.
I mean, I think it sets a tone of, you know, the hospitals have always been where the money is. You know, big growth, you know, a lot of money. You know, obviously we're talking $2.2 billion. You know, their commitment, quite frankly, you know, sets a tone for everything we're trying to accomplish.
Gobe says the next big step for the Green Mountain Care Board is to develop a payment reform system for hospitals that replaces the current fee-for-service model.
They can't just cut volume and not destroy their ability to have a margin. So they've got to be paid for taking, you know, responsibility for the health of a population. And, you know, that's where we want to go. And it's going to take us some time to get there, but it's, you know, certainly the goal.
And it's a tall order. Find a way to cut costs without harming patients in the long run or the short run. In fact, the goal is to both cut costs and improve patient outcome and do it in the face of uncertain payment reform efforts. Today on the program, we're going to learn a little bit more about how hospital budgets are changing and where the state reform efforts in payment and budgeting come in. Listeners, if you have questions about this complicated process, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined now by Tom Huebner, President and CEO of Rutland Regional Medical Center. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So this may seem simplistic, but in the complicated world of healthcare, things seem to get confusing very quickly. So can you start just by explaining the difference between cost and how you charge for things versus payment, who's paying for the stuff, whether it's private insurers, individuals, or the government? So what's the difference between how you charge and what things cost versus who it is that's actually giving you the money?
Exactly. So cost is just what you think it is. It's how much it costs us to provide a service for our patients. Whether it's a lab service or a surgery or an inpatient stay, we can assess what that cost is. We are then paid by various insurers, Medicare, Medicaid, Blue Cross, etc. The prices, though, vary a lot because Medicare and Medicaid pay us well below cost. So we charge the commercial carriers like a Blue Cross or a Cigna MVP more. And we charge them on a per unit basis. That is, for every lab test given, for every patient day, for every surgery, there's an individual charge.
Right. So if you are a patient looking at a bill and you have a private insurance company, what that charge is for the lab procedure that you got done is not necessarily the cost of the procedure.
In fact, it's absolutely higher than the cost of the procedure because of the so-called cost shift from government payers to commercial carriers.
So let's spend a little bit of time talking about cost and budgeting and how those things might change. And then after the break, we'll focus on payment and payment reform efforts, including single payer. So on the cost side of things, you currently use a fee-for-service system, which most of us, I think, are pretty familiar with. And in fact, it's kind of what I was describing there. You get a lab test, and then you get a bill for that test. That test has a fee attached to it. So does an office visit if you're just you know, having a well checkup from your doctor. You're interested in moving to a global budgeting system. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, so cost is really made up of two pieces, what that cost per unit of services are and how many services are delivered. Where we think there is a big opportunity is that we should be delivering, in some cases, fewer units of service, not by making access less available to people, but by ensuring that all the care that is rendered is absolutely necessary, that there's no waste in the system. It's estimated that on a national level, 30% of the care rendered to patients is not necessary. And what we are looking to do to reduce cost is to incent the reduction of inappropriate utilization. And let me give you an example. We've been working on readmissions of congestive heart failure patients. nationally, about 25% of those patients, they're very sick, fragile folks, are readmitted to hospitals within 30 days. We've been working hard to make sure that we have good, seamless care, and in Rutland have been able to get that readmission rate down to 15%. We've made a big impact there, and that reduces utilization and therefore cost to the system. That is both good from a price and cost point of view and good from a quality and patient care point of view.
But not good from the point of view of a hospital that right now has an incentive to have more of those services so that you can have more money coming in, right?
Exactly. So hospitals are big institutions. The listeners all know that. Most of our costs are fixed. About 70% of them don't vary with volume. So they hang around whether we have 100 patients or 10 patients.
Like what? What might be an example of that?
So in the emergency department's a great example. At Rutland Regional, we see 35,000 people a year in our emergency department. If our volume in the emergency department dropped by half, our costs would not drop by half. We have to be there ready for when a patient comes in the door. Some costs can drop. Some of them are variable with the volume, but not all. In fact, most are not. You have that cost of just being there and being ready for your patients. It's not really different than a fire department in some ways.
Right. The lights are on, the doctors and nurses and all staff are there. Everything is up and running, assuming that you might get somebody in.
So that's exactly right. And what you want to do is create an incentive so that utilization can go down in a responsible way that's good for patients, but also preserve the infrastructure we all count on to provide care in our communities.
So in a situation like that, though, would people be paying for, I mean, this is an extreme example, but paying for a hospital that has all these empty beds, even though they're empty? You know, how do you make sure that you're not then overpaying for things that the hospital isn't using?
Sure. I mean, you want to be taking a look at the overall size of the system to make sure it's not overbuilt and that it isn't too large. But you really do need to incent change from where we are today. We can't stay with the status quo. We need to drive that volume down and provide good incentives to have it. In Vermont, it's very hard to imagine that we would be doing without one of the 14 hospitals that are currently serving our state. They may change a lot. They may look a lot different than they do today. In fact, they look a lot different than they did 20 years ago. And you want to incent that change in a way that can that really does reduce costs in a very real way, but also gives Vermonters reasonable access to services across the entire state.
Let me read you two emails that we got and see if what we're talking about here with this idea of going to global budgeting would sync with what the listeners are asking here. First of all, Kurt says they should get paid less for useless, expensive tests. I went to Fletcher Allen for a painful growth on my foot. It didn't even need imaging because it was easy to feel, but the doctor insisted on an MRI. They charged my insurance $5,000 for the MRI, and nothing even showed up on the image. Then the doctor refused to remove the growth because he couldn't see anything on the MRI. And then Andrew says, my primary health care nurse practitioner sent me to a dermatologist to have a mole checked. The mole was benign. After a few questions and a measurement, the appointment was over. What followed was a $300 charge for a 3-minute visit. They upcoded me because the doctor asked me, quote, how are you doing? Upcoding is unethical, and hospitals use this to drive up revenue. No clinic or hospital should charge a patient $100 for asking, how are you doing? So would global budgeting address those concerns and frustrations?
At least some of them. So mixed in there are some questions about the clinical efficacy of some of the testing that was done, and I don't have enough information, honestly, to make a judgment
Sure.
about that. But what you do want to do is create an incentive so that physicians, nurse practitioners, hospitals are providing enough care. We don't want to go back to the days of managed care where people thought, gosh, I'm being underserved. But we do want to create enough incentive so that if a test isn't really clinically helpful, there's no incentive from a financial point of view to do it.
You tried to do global budgeting this year, but weren't able to get it ramped up. Why not?
Well, the state wasn't quite ready. Medicaid said that it was a little too fast, too soon. We were advocating starting with commercial carriers and Medicaid this October 1st, and with the hope of bringing Medicare on next year. And everybody said, too quick, let's slow down, let's take some more time. But we continue to advocate for that approach. And as you heard Al Gobet say a little bit ago on the show here, we do need to move away from fee-for-service, and global budget is a good model for doing that. That's been proven in some other states, including Maryland particularly, and also Washington.
So I promised that we'd talk about the payment side of things later, but let me just ask, when we're connecting this global budgeting to payment, how would that work right now with a global budgeting system when you've got so many different entities on the payment side?
So it essentially assets a budget for a hospital and its specialists. I think those are important to include, and says, here is your cost historically. Next year, we're going to give you enough for general inflation, the inflation in the community at large, not medical inflation. And you're going to be limited to that amount of money. If you do more, you're not going to get any more. If you do less than that, you're going to be able to keep enough of it to cover your fixed costs, that 70% that we talked about earlier, so that your infrastructure, your cost of being ready for the next patient is not diminished. But you have an incentive to drive out that volume that doesn't make sense, that is unnecessary for providing great care for our communities.
What does that look like, though, to send? What does the bill look like if you then, if I go in for a procedure, what does my insurance carrier get from you?
Sure. Through the course of the year, it looks the same. A bill would go out and it would be paid. It comes, though, at the reconciliation process at the end. If we provide too much volume during the course of the year, we have to give that money back, essentially. And it's given back to each of the payers in relation to the percentage of the work we do. So if Blue Cross is 25% of our patients, they would get 25% of that money that's returned, and that goes back ultimately to their employers and to the patients who we are serving.
Does it have to go back to the patients? Would that be a requirement in it?
It would be through premium reduction. So however that works out, now people have very different kinds of insurance programs with different levels of deductible and copays and who's paying their premiums. All of that has to be it has to follow the contracts that are in place around that.
So basically, the bill that Blue Cross Blue Shield gets and that the customer gets to look at, the patient looks at, would still look like it. You're being charged for each individual procedure, but at the end, when you're reconciling it all, if you're over budget, you have to give some of that back.
That's right. And What you're really driving towards is controlling insurance premiums. So you want premiums or cost to a Medicare or Medicaid program to stop going up at rates well above inflation. You're limiting that. And most of the savings that I think need to occur in the system are coming out of the hospital side, as Al Gobet said earlier, and out of the specialist side. So it is really by moderating the cost increase to health insurance premiums and to state and federal budgets through the government paid services.
We're talking today about hospital budgeting. We're looking at how hospitals currently budget, how they might change the way that works, how it all fits into payment reform systems that are getting underway. If you have a question about this, it's very complicated, but if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts, your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's bring in Richard Slusky. He's the director of payment reform for the Green Mountain Care Board. And as we're looking here about state payment reform systems and hospital reform budgets, they're intertwined. Richard Slusky, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's just ask, first of all, what do you think about global budgeting? Would that work for the state?
Well, it's the state's goal is to move away from the fee-for-service payments that Tom was talking about earlier to some form of alternative payment that's more value-based and not paying for each unit of service that's provided. So global budget certainly is one form of payment methodology that would fit into that definition and I think would meet our goals, yes.
Do you have any concerns about it?
I think that on the positive side, the global budget provides the hospitals with incentives, as Tom noted, to reduce avoidable utilization. And it actually, in a way, it changes everything that's currently revenue for the hospital into cost. So they really have to start thinking about what services are adding value for individual patients, et cetera, and which are not and maybe could be avoided in the future. The concern about global budgets, as any payment methodology, has consequences. Fee-for-service tends to lead to overutilization or overtreatment. Global budget has the risk of incenting the providers to avoid treatment of high-risk or high-cost patients or to transfer patients to other facilities. So we have to build into the system measures that will allow us to monitor the services that are provided, make sure that patient access is adequate, and also that the quality of care remains very high in Vermont.
Let's go to Jack, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Jack. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. I think my question is a good follow-up to the last comment. You know, it's all well and good for politicians, statisticians, and political appointees to talk in the abstract about putting patient, health, practically speaking, their very lives right in the middle of a so-called operational opportunity. But, you know, where will the safeguards come so that incentivizing opportunity doesn't lead to diminished quality? And, you know, really, in many instances, these tests are a one-time, you know, opportunity for people to have lives saved, and you don't get a second chance. And so cutting costs ahead of providing the safeguards seems like a rather reckless thing to do, in my opinion.
Yeah, Jack, let me put that to both of our guests here. Richard Slusky first, safeguards to put in place for this kind of system.
Yes, so we're not intending to cut costs initially in the system. I think what we're trying to do is look at what's being spent in the system today, recognizing that there are probably some inefficiencies in the system as it currently exists, but building a regulatory environment, in effect, through the board that really restrains the growth of healthcare expenditures over time, and also over time begins to weed out some of the inappropriate services that really aren't adding value for patients. And we do have a number of safeguards to make sure that patients are getting adequate care. We have performance measures that we've worked on for almost 2 years now. We risk adjust payments so that patients who are in need of more services, the provider actually receives additional services for those patients. And we also want to monitor referral patterns to make sure that the providers are not moving patients away from their service to other providers. So we do have some safeguards that really didn't exist in the managed care era in the 90s, and we feel pretty confident that we can manage and make sure that Vermonters are getting the care that they do need.
Tom Huebner, how do you address this? I mean, you can hear patients looking at this whole reform system and then feeling like they go to the hospital and a test isn't offered, and they're wondering, is this because you want to make more revenue or because you really don't think it's necessary? You know, how do you reassure them? And then how do you also make a shift in doctors who say, yes, but I want to offer this test because maybe it'll be diagnostic. It might not be, but maybe it will.
Yeah, I mean, and you heard the reverse from your email commenter earlier, right? They were worried about the incentives where we're doing stuff that you didn't really need to do in order to run up a bill. So Richard's got it quite right. You have to do it very carefully and balanced, and there has to be clear reporting and oversight. So there have to be and are in place quality oversight metrics to ensure that we don't do it on the backs of good care. Green Mountain Care Board has done that through their ACO quality metrics and continue to do that. We also can't do it by just referring patients away from our hospital to some other organization so that they get the care there and we get to still keep the money. That's clearly not sustainable and not okay. So we have to do that. And your point is right about physicians. Physicians also have to have aligned incentives. So the good news, or part of the news that makes this possible now, is that most physicians are no longer independent. Most of them either work for a hospital system or for another large organization like a federally qualified health center. So in our world, all of the specialists who order most of the most expensive tests are employed by Rutland Regional. We would want to have the same incentives flow down to them, cascade down to them, so they are properly incented as well. But it has to be balanced, as your caller said. We can't go back to the days of managed care in the 90s where people believed that they weren't getting adequate care, that they weren't getting access. You know, when we've looked at what Vermonters really want out of the healthcare system, they all want cost to not increase as rapidly as they have. That needs to slow to the rate of the general economy. But they also want to have great access, and they want to be able to choose their own doctors and hospitals and be assured that they're getting great quality. It's very important to balance that out. But it's important to note, too, that the status quo is not sustainable. We can't have cost increases in healthcare that are twice the rate of general inflation and think that we're going to have an economically viable economy. That's not a realistic goal. So we need to have balance.
So Richard Slusky, looking at that need for balance and knowing that the state is moving forward on a number of initiatives, what's the timeline for figuring out what kind of payment reform system is needed as we're also, as a state, moving towards a single-payer system?
Well, we're trying to implement, or at least plan for the implementation of these payment methodologies that move away from fee-for-service as quickly as we can. And so we're hoping at this point, sometime in 2016, hopefully by January of 2016, that we'll be able to begin to move toward some of these alternative payment initiatives. 2017 certainly is a target for implementation of Green Mountain Care and you know, eligibility for some of the waivers from the ACA. So we are looking at the 2016-2017 timeframe for implementation of these types of payment reforms. And I should say that the payment reforms are intended to incent delivery system reform. So what our real goal here is to improve the way care is delivered, the coordination of care among providers in transitions of care when people move from provider to provider, and also develop the information systems that are necessary to provide the data that the providers are going to need in order to monitor their performance and the way they're caring for their patients. So there's a lot to be done, but Vermont has a great opportunity right now to achieve some really remarkable results, I think, in payment and delivery system reform for the benefit of our patients.
Well, stay tuned is sort of the answer to that too then, isn't it? Richard Slusky is the Director of Payment Reform for the Green Mountain Care Board. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
We're also talking today with Tom Huebner. He's President and CEO of Rutland Regional Medical Center. Tom's going to stay with us. And coming up after the break, we'll also talk with Joe Wooden, who's CEO and President of Gifford Medical Center. Look at the differences between some of the smaller hospitals and larger hospitals in the state. And if you have a question about hospital budgets, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Tom Huebner, President and CEO of Rutland Regional Medical Center, is with us today, helping explain the complicated beast that is hospital budgeting. We've looked a little bit at the state position and influence on the process, and if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Deb, who's calling in from Richmond. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the outcomes-based payments. And under the old format, it was fee for service, and doctors prescribed lots of services. But in this format, if a patient simply does not comply with the doctor's orders, so for example, a 62-year-old woman doesn't lose 20 pounds in a six-month period, the doctor isn't going to have the outcomes that that office wants to have. What mechanisms are in place to protect patients from being dropped by their doctor's offices when they're not getting with the program and following doctor's orders?
Deb, thanks for the call. Tom Huebner?
So this system does not incent at the individual patient level to begin with, and that's the important beginning of that. And part of what we need to do, though, as a healthcare system is to become more effective at getting patients to participate in their care, to be an active member of that, and to want to be losing the weight or following through on taking their medications or doing any of the other pieces that are necessary to keep themselves well. Right now, we're not incented to do that at all, actually, and we want to be. We need to be, because that's actually where a lot of the opportunity lies. My congestive heart failure patients that I was describing earlier, the big improvements we've made there was getting our patients to take their medicines, to make sure they're going to their follow-up appointments. And was it true that every one of them was compliant, every one of them improved? No, but we helped them. We had case managers who worked with them to try to encourage them to make the changes in their lives that they needed to. And that's what made the difference. So you don't want to incent at the individual patient level. You don't want to ever be blaming the patient. But we need to get really good at wrapping our arms around those patients to make sure they're getting the kind of care that will have the very best possible outcome, including an outcome that can reduce cost.
Let's get another voice in here while we're talking about all of this. Joe Wooden is CEO and president of Gifford Medical Center. That's one of the state's smaller hospitals. And let's look a little bit about how some of those hospitals are going to be reacting and acting in this era of the Green Mountain Care Board and the Affordable Care Act. Joe, nice to have you on the program.
Yeah, thanks.
Are you looking at payment reform systems of the type that we've been talking about with Tom Huebner?
Oh, absolutely. And I just wanted to comment on that last subject. The issue of personal responsibility is, you know, it's been before us for many years. And when we look at these payment reform issues and we look at maybe lump sum payments for hospitals or healthcare systems, again, that issue of how we work with patients, how we ensure that we're helping people stay well and make those choices, it's going to be in front of us even more so than it has in the past. So that's both scary and exciting at the same time.
In this year's budget, the Shumlin administration decided to rescind a projected increase in Medicaid reimbursement rates. I'd love for both of you to explain what kind of effect that might have on your budgeting. Joe Wooden, you first.
Yes, well, that issue is certainly of concern to us just because the state Medicaid program, we're looking to make sure that we're developing, you know, affordable, more universal coverage, and the state's ability to pay for that in the current Medicaid program is a concern because we have to look as we reform healthcare and go to these different models, we have to make sure that there's enough money in the system for us to not only transition but to maintain those models. So anytime we sort of run into the state's affordability of Medicaid, it has a big effect on our budget and on some of the direction and on those questions that we always ask, you know, what can we afford as a state? What can we afford as a system? And that's always in front of us. I think the issue of cost and affordability for individuals continues to sort of plague us. So it's a concern when that happens. We're always hopeful that when we work together, we can figure out how we can afford these things. But when there's cuts in the Medicaid reimbursement rate, it does cause a lot of concern and anxiety.
So when you say that causes concern and anxiety, does it weaken whatever confidence you may have in the state to be able to do a single-payer system?
It brings that into question because, again, we have to talk about what types of benefits are we offering, what types of benefits can we afford, and how are we going to pay for these, which is an issue before us, and we're hopefully going to see some clarification on that coming up next year in terms of raising some of those funds. So those are tough discussions, and they don't just reside in the hospital or the doctors. I think the whole community and you know, all the public needs to talk about that issue. It's a tough issue that we shy away from, and that is what can we afford versus what would we like? You know, those two may not be the same.
Tom Huebner, I mean, looking then at budgeting, we're looking at this no increase, so level-funded Medicaid budget. And then I understand, I would love for you to address one of the issues that you've been seeing with Vermont Health Connect and the Affordable Care Act and bad debt coming into the system, which may compound a budget issue.
So I got to go back to the Medicaid just for a moment, and I
sure.
will go to bad debt. You know, I think of health care reform as two big buckets. How we collect the money, that is how we raise it. Do we do it through employer-based and some tax dollars with Medicare and Medicaid, or do we go to an all publicly funded system? The other bucket of reform is the change in the way we pay for care, as we've been talking about this morning. The collection, though, of money is important because we want to make sure there's adequate funds. And the Medicaid cut is that small cut in and of itself is not concerning. Not hugely concerning, but over a course of time, as we began this program, we talked about the cost shift and Medicare and Medicaid chronically underfunding the cost of care. I've been doing this a long time. I've been in healthcare for 39 years, and we've always had to rely on commercial payers to make up for what government didn't properly pay for. And I worry about that in single payer. It's not a philosophical concern at all, but on a practical level, I do worry about that. And to bad debt, we have seen a large percentage of people on the healthcare exchange buying bronze and silver plans, which have large deductibles, $5,000. And those deductibles, sometimes when patients are now showing up for care, they need surgery, something's happened, they've been in a car accident, those deductibles seem very large. And in fact, we believe we are seeing that our bad debts are going up as a result of that.
Hmm.
So it's still early. That data is still new, but we are seeing that as one of the factors affecting us.
Joe Wooden, can you infuse a note of optimism here or not as we move forward with all these payment reform efforts? I mean, we heard Tom Huebner say earlier, this is not a sustainable system, but there's a lot of concern about where we're going and how it feels to patients. So what are you feeling?
Thanks for asking me that. Well, I think that we have a lot of passion and desire for healthcare being a right, and I think there's been sort of a history of ethics with all of us sort of pursuing that, and that's exciting. I think we need to equally bring to the table, though, some of the less glamorous discussions about how you pay for it, how you raise the money. These are not as exciting and passionate discussions, but we have to sort of say that's important because otherwise we may not get there. We may not get to that redesigned system that I think we all want and would appreciate and think it's going to provide more value and better quality care and better access. But we really need to start inviting some of those less glamorous subjects to the table so that we can work through them. So it doesn't sell well. It's not an exciting political discussion. But if we don't have them, I fear that some of our direction might get thwarted significantly.
So. And I am optimistic about it because I see so many people leaning forward, being willing to try new things and experiment because we know that we must move forward. People who used to just put their heads in the sand, so many people now are really looking for solutions. And to me, that's the great optimism of the moment.
Well, I really appreciate both of you taking some time to talk to us about this, as you said, unsexy kind of conversation, but very important as we talk about how we're going to pay for healthcare. Mm-hmm. Joe Wooden is CEO and president of Gifford Medical Center. Tom Huebner is president and CEO of Rutland Regional Medical Center. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you. Yep.
Coming up, we speak with Vermont novelist Sarah Healy about her new novel, which addresses how families deal with generational mental illness and the discovery of secrets long buried. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Going back to your childhood home to visit your parents can be awkward, especially if you are 30, if your 38-year-old brother still lives at home and your mother is a hoarder. But sometimes going back is exactly what you need to do to move forward. That's the theme of Vermont author Sarah Healy's new novel, House of Wonder. Healy spoke with producer Sage Van Wing about the book. Here she is reading a passage.
We lived on a cul-de-sac in a town called Hardwick in the state of New Jersey. It was, in many ways, a brightly lit stage, so everyone knew about Warren. "How's your son?" they would ask my mother. And she'd crease her brow and soften her smile and reply that he was good, thanks for asking, in a manner that made them feel benevolent and kind. "You know, I asked after that Parsons kid," they'd say later that night over their own dinners of soup can chicken. "Priscilla says he's doing well." And then they'd sink down in their seats, enjoying their armchair compassion. In that way, Warren performed a great community service. My mother had managed to make him, if not beloved, then at least accepted. The first time Warren ran away, everyone was sympathetic. The principal called, lasagnas arrived with nice notes, and friends' mothers implored me to tell my mom that if she needed anything, anything at all. And then their voices would trail off. I was never sure exactly what I was supposed to communicate, but when I would arrive home and see my mother pacing through the house, holding Warren's pillow, I knew it didn't really matter. And everyone was happy when he returned, or they appeared to be, at least. But as Warren's childhood eccentricities lingered past adolescence, as he continued to disappear, as he reached the age where he was supposed to be growing out of it, their collective goodwill became sapped.
All right. So this is a book about families and what keeps them together and communities and what breaks them apart. Mm-hmm. But it's also definitely about mental illness. Mm-hmm. And yet it seems as though you're very clear in the book never to specifically name a mental illness. And the characters themselves always kind of dance around it in some way. Why was it important to you to do it that way?
I think for a few reasons. One thing is, I do remember growing up, there were people who were just different and people who were just odd. And, you know, there wasn't really the language to necessarily give everyone an appropriate label at that time. And, you know, now we have those labels and we do have the ability and kind of impulse to pathologize everything. And while that's helpful in a lot of ways, you know, it gives a treatment protocol, it helps people understand how to communicate and work with someone with a mental illness. I think that sometimes, you know, we might lose something in always looking at someone via a specific label rather than, you know, really as individuals. And with Priscilla, who's the mother in this story, and Warren, who's the twin brother of the protagonist, they are very different and they do definitely have issues. But really what I hope to do is to make sure that their humanity outshone whatever those issues were.
Mm-hmm. So like you were saying, the main plot line in the book is about Jenna, a single mother in her mid-30s trying to cope with her own life, and then the issues of her twin brother, Warren, who's living at home with their mother, Priscilla. And then there's another storyline which runs through the book, which is the back history of Jenna and Warren's mother, Priscilla, who struggles with her own mental illness, which seems to be sort of a hoarding problem. And her mother, who also appeared to have some kind of issues with normal society.
Right.
Was there something that you were trying to say about family history and mental illness going back through family history?
Well, I think that there is a lot of evidence for that. And I think that a lot of families, you know, if you start asking about, you know, looking into your family history a little bit more, I think that you see that. But really, I don't think that I was trying to make a point about the hereditary nature of mental illness, but really just show it through different lenses of time, you know, and how it's treated through these different historical periods. And really, while this book does have a lot to do with mental illness, it really, I don't, like, even the characters with their issues, like Priscilla with her issues of her shopaholic behavior, like she, to me, even though she has those issues, it almost makes her, when you hear that in a vacuum, it makes her sound repellent, but really she's lovely and warm and wonderful and big-hearted and kind. And you see through the passages that deal with her childhood, I hope that I've managed to, you know, give the reader a real sense of where she comes from and how she ended up the way she did, and really make her more than one-dimensional, make her more than a label, make her more than a shopaholic or a hoarder, but make her this really flesh and blood, like, really interesting, amazing woman that I think she is.
I think it's interesting because there is actually kind of a lot of female empowerment in the book in a way. You know, as Priscilla starts off being kind of a beauty queen and her father tells her she's nothing except beautiful. And then she manages to make kind of so much more of herself. And the same is true with Jenna. They are very fully fleshed out, really human characters. But there is also kind of an element of strength, especially in the female characters in the book.
Yeah, I think that, well, I think Priscilla especially, she came from a time and a place, you know, Texas in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and she came from a time and a place where the most important thing a woman could be was pretty. And that's changed now, and it's not as relevant anymore. And but she's very much a product of that. And so to her, beauty was the only commodity in which she could trade, you know, like that was it. And so she did use that to her advantage, and not in a manipulative way, but in like kind of a really touching, like almost desperate way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Jenna, the main character, and Warren are twins. And I know I've always sort of had a fascination with twins. I wonder, did you do a lot of research about twins and how they work before you were writing? I didn't.
But it is. But twins have always fascinated me, and has it seemed like the twins I've known have had a really special connection and a really almost supernatural connection. And so that is something that I brought to Jenna and Warren.
Yeah, they do have a really special relationship. That's clear. But then it also seems clear that Jenna kind of has forgotten about or put that relationship away and almost kind of started to treat her brother the way maybe everyone else treats him, mm-hmm. until she sees him with her own daughter, mm-hmm. and kind of that childishness, that childlikeness she sees that again. To me, that felt like kind of the crux of the book, of mm-hmm. her seeing her brother again. And I wonder, was that an important moment for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that really, I mean, a lot of this book is returning to your childhood, or Jenna returning to her childhood. She returns to her childhood home. She returns to some of the, you know, some of the traumas and hurts and pains in her childhood. And really, she gets back to the connection she had with Warren when they were children. And really, I mean, that's the critical point when she can start to move forward with her life. You know, when she, mm-hmm. it's almost like she had to go back to be able to move forward. And really, I think of this book for Jenna as a coming of age story. And she's just older than is typical for, you know, is typical for the genre. But I've always wondered about these. You know, Jenna's in her mid-30s, but I've always wondered, with coming-of-age stories, there are all these, like, self-aware 16-year-olds who have everything, like, totally figured out, when most adults I know are still figuring it out.
Yeah. You did seem – everyone in the book is doing a lot of kind of retelling of things that maybe they've kept hidden, mm-hmm. kind of for a while, so there's a lot of sort of skeletons in the closet.
Yep.
What is it that you wanted to say kind of about the nature of – uncovering that sort of loss and moving forward?
I just think old wounds can just be very damaging. And in keeping things hidden and keeping things kind of internalized can be very damaging. And you see that with Priscilla's character. And it's funny because Warren probably is the most handicapped character in the book. But Warren, I viewed him almost as like a master of ceremonies. Like Warren is like this mystical, wonderful, strange, otherworldly, weird guy who kind of brings Jenna back to her hometown. Like, his actions drive the plot forward in a very pivotal way. And ultimately, Warren is the unlikely hero of this book. And I just, it was really important to me that that he get to be.
Another thing it seems like you spent a lot of time with in this book is the location.
Mm-hmm.
That really felt like, the location to me almost felt like another character.
Yeah.
In the book. And that is suburbia.
Yep.
It's a very un-Vermont kind of location.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in some kind of suburbia?
I did. I grew up in New Jersey, and my last two books have been set there. And I think you're absolutely right that the setting was another character. And to me, suburbia is almost like a perfect metaphor for adolescence, because it's this place where, like, you know, deviation from the norm is kind of disallowed, where, you know, oddities really stand out against what's typical. You know, really, you just want to be normal and you just want to fit in. And that's kind of adolescence. You know, it's kind of that stage where Jenna started to break away from her family. So, I think that's true.
Yeah. But then forcing her to come back forces mm-hmm. her to confront that, maybe that period in her adolescence,
yeah.
and she can move forward.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
So what's it like for you going back to New Jersey from Vermont?
Oh, I love to go back to New Jersey. I do. All my family is still there. And really, I think that where Vermont fits into this is that it gives me perspective on, you know, it gives me, you know, that long view of some of these some of those attributes of suburbia and some of the dynamics of suburbia, because I don't live in that environment here. And so having that kind of long-range perspective from via being in Vermont is very helpful, and I think really drives a lot of my writing.
All right. Sarah Healy lives in Williston, and her novel is House of Wonder. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Healy spoke with producer Sage Van Wing. And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, Dan Feliciano. He's the Libertarian candidate for governor, and he's gained more attention than Libertarians usually do in Vermont, thanks to a write-in campaign in the Republican primary. Feliciano has been sharply attacking incumbent Governor Peter Shumlin's health care policies. We'll talk about that and other issues with the candidate tomorrow at noon. Send your questions for Dan Feliciano to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.